Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. States are getting ready for Obamacare.
I think individuals are really going to be surprised
that they could qualify for some amount of premium assistance on the exchange.
One of this year's inspiring West Virginians is a businesswoman from Morgantown.
She cares about her clients. She checks up on us to make sure we're happy, and if there's things that aren't working well, she makes sure they get corrected. But I also think she's a very good employer.
Kentucky's poet laureate talks about his work and diversity in Appalachia.
Well, I would say my contributions include forcing a discussion of the true diversity of the region.
And we visit a school in North Carolina where the Cherokee language is taught.
You can't put a dollar value to an effect on protecting your tribe and who you are.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. A major provision in the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, goes into effect on Tuesday. That's when the public can start shopping on the health care exchanges that make insurance available for everyone. In Kentucky, a group called Voices for Health is working with diverse organizations throughout the state to educate citizens about the new insurance marketplace, which is called Connect and spelled K-Y-N-E-C-T. Uninsured Kentuckians can use the exchange to begin enrolling in a health care plan Tuesday. The executive director of Kentucky Voices for Health, Reagan Hunt, says her group is crisscrossing the state using a calendar of outreach events to explain the ACA and how it affects consumers and businesses.
Recently, we were in Madison County, which is the home of two universities, Eastern Kentucky University and Berea College. And we had six groups be in that county on the same day, intentionally, so that we could hit retired teachers and the library staff and students and a homeless shelter all at one time.
Hunt admits getting the word out is a tall order.
Kentucky has about 640,000 people who currently don't have health insurance, and that's a huge number. That's over 17% of our state's population. So there's been a clear understanding that our state's success is contingent upon everyone's interactions with Kentucky, not just paid media outreach.
Hunt says Kentucky Voices for Health is working with organizations like the AARP and YMCA to schedule presentations in communities throughout the Commonwealth. Hunt says documents with information about the law and Connect are also being circulated at drugstores, health clinics, and places like the YMCA. The Affordable Care Act requires all individuals to have health insurance next year or pay a penalty. Meanwhile, Connect's director, Carrie Banahan, says the office is ready to begin enrolling Kentuckians. Banahan says people can go online and shop for a plan that best suits them. She says individuals will be able to choose from bronze, silver, gold, or platinum coverage, and she believes most will like the rates being offered.
I think individuals are really going to be surprised
that they could qualify for some amount of premium assistance on the exchange and, affordable coverage. We're going to have a lot of affordable plans on the exchange.
Banahan shared some examples of the rates with House and Senate members Thursday. She says a couple making $34,000 a year would qualify for a monthly federal subsidy of $520 and could purchase the most economical plan for $567 a month. In effect, she says, that couple would be paying $47 a month for health insurance. Kentucky Education Commissioner Terry Holliday says while most students improved their overall test results from last school year, the state still needs to do a better job with math. As Kentucky Public Radio's Devin Katanyama reports, the Education Department released its annual data measuring individuals' school and district success on Friday.
This is the first time Kentucky can compare test results since it introduced its accountability system last year. Although a majority of schools met their objectives for the year, it's apparent why Holliday says he's concerned about the state's math scores. In high schools, the number of students testing proficient or above dropped to 36%. Holliday says the state needs to do a better job preparing teachers and students.
We're extremely concerned about math. We have made math our number one focus this year, especially in middle school.
Hundreds of schools schools did not meet their goals for the year, but Holiday says it's possible those schools can still be high achieving. Holiday adds, while the 55% of students who are graduating college or career ready is a large improvement, the state's 86% graduation rate means some students are not ready for life after high school. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Devin Katayama.
Four Kentucky elementary schools and one high school have been named 2013 National Blue Ribbon Schools. The national program recognizes academic performance and improvement. Glendover Elementary is the fifth Lexington school to achieve this honor since 1989. Principal Kathy Fine says Glendover has seen an increasing number of low-income students.
We are a high-achieving school in the state, but we also won it with over 40% free and reduced lunch, and we are a Title I school. And I think that validates the fact that good teaching leads to good results no matter which students you have to teach.
In addition to Glendover, the other honorees are Logan County's Auburn Elementary, Boone County's Mann Elementary, Star Elementary of Carter County, and Beechwood High School. Two West Virginia schools also made the list, Monongah Middle School in Marion County and Panther Creek Elementary School in Nicholas County. There's a trend in higher education to tie state funding to graduation rates. Kentucky's public universities will apparently seek money in the next state budget that would be divided among them based on their number of graduates. That's what the president of the Council on Postsecondary Education told Insight Cable's Pure Politics. Robert King says details are still being worked out among the schools, but they've agreed in principle to the concept.
Campuses will earn those dollars because they've produced more associate degrees, more bachelor's degrees, more master's, PhDs, professional degrees. And that's something that we're seeing. The president has talked about it, President Obama. We're seeing it in a number of other states as a way of linking university and community college performance to funding.
King tells Pure Politics the universities also plan to seek funding for the Bucks for Brains Scholarship Program. Beginning next summer, Eastern Kentucky University will ban all tobacco products on its campuses. Given the health threats posed by secondhand smoke, President Michael Benson says cigarettes should be banned. Another vice that's popular among college students is drinking. Drunken college students are almost as common on campus as football games and Saturday night parties. The penalties for the providers and abusers of alcohol are tough, but as WEKU's Stu Johnson reports, some young people now pursue drunkenness with a new intensity.
Times change, and apparently so have drinking habits. Mike Razor, who directs enforcement in the Department for Alcoholic Beverage Control, believes too many kids set out to get drunk today. Besides risky behavior, Razor says blood alcohol levels of 0.4 and higher can be fatal. The danger has only intensified the crackdown by the ABC. Assisting in the effort is a new law that allows an underage drinker to summon help without fear of prosecution.
Basically what it means is if there's somebody in danger from alcohol or anything like that, you have got an opportunity to call for help and not be in trouble.
While the amnesty's aim is to provide a quick medical response to the victims of alcohol poisoning, the ABC is also working to keep alcohol beyond their reach. The state agency commonly uses sting operations, in which minors attempt to buy beer and liquor from retailers and saloons. They also target underaged buyers, with ABC agents posing as liquor store clerks. Plus, they patrol tailgate parties commonly seen before college and high school athletic events. Razor says fake identification remains all too common, but few people fully realize the potential penalty.
If you have a false ID or driver's license, you could be considered a forged instrument, which could be a felony charge. And I don't know that I would want to have a felony charge on my record for a bottle of beer.
If someone underage borrows an adult ID, Razor says the borrower could lose driving privileges for a year. He adds most liquor stores and bars don't want to sell to underage drinkers. In fact, Razor says about 90% comply with alcohol laws. A Saturday night in downtown Lexington means increased foot traffic at restaurants and bars near the University of Kentucky. The Tin Roof is a popular college hangout. And bar manager Patrick Edmondson says his staff is well-trained and ready for underage drinkers.
You know, we're going to ID them at the door. We got door guys working after 10 o'clock every night, so nobody underage is going to get in here. Then we got servers, bartenders that know what they're doing, have been to all the classes, the ABC classes and everything, know what they're looking for.
Edmondson says he and his staff don't hesitate to call upon Lexington police when they have someone underage causing a fuss.
We've kind of built that relationship over the past couple of years, so we've been open for 4.5 years now, so we've built that relationship with them. They're good to us. We try to be good to them as good as we can.
A couple of blocks away, a steady stream of college-aged buyers flow through Coliseum Liquors. Owner Sharish Patel says about 70% of his business comes from UK. He says the first few weeks of fall classes are when he sees a lot of fake IDs. Two UK freshmen are enjoying an ice cream cone. Lexington's Jesse Dalton hasn't felt pressure to drink so far, and Dalton admits the penalties associated with underage drinking are a definite deterrent.
The money, if you got in trouble, if you got not necessarily arrested, but like written up, you know, I know that you would have to pay fines, go to court, try to get it off your record, all that stuff.
Co-ed Kiera Black comes to Lexington from near Atlanta, where she says underage buying is not too difficult. Like Dalton, though, she worries about the long-term impact of citations and fines.
I'm very major and very goal-oriented. And I can't say that all college students are like that because, there are kids that come in with undecided majors. They don't have an idea of what they want to do, but I do. So that threat is definitely there and definitely, you know, makes me think twice before I do something.
But trying to do something illegal is in some ways increasingly being made more convenient. ABC Enforcement Director Mike Razor says there are more liquor stores, more bars, and more Kentucky counties that allow the sale of alcohol.
Well, these are expanding tenfold over the state. There's a wet-dry election constantly, and so our area of responsibility is increasing.
While alcohol is more available, Razor says his agency has seen historic staff reductions. Over the last decade, he says budget cuts have reduced the number of investigators by about a third. For WEKU News, I'm Stu Johnson.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. For the fourth year, West Virginia Public Radio has presented Inspiring West Virginians, a radio documentary with stories about people who have made a mark in their community, the state, and even the nation. Starting today and over the next 3 weeks, Inside Appalachia will feature profiles by independent producer Gene Snediger of this year's Inspiring West Virginians, beginning with the state's current Small Business Person of the Year, Diane Lewis, an African-American entrepreneur who, despite growing up in poverty, has built a thriving business employing hundreds of people in multiple states.
Diane, we've just come down 79, and here we are at the...
It's called I-79 High Technology Corridor, and we work for the West Virginia High Technology Consortium Foundation, and we do the security, maintenance, and janitorial for all these facilities here. It's one of our commercial clients.
My name is Diane Lewis. I am the President and CEO of Action Facilities Management. I grew up in Clarksburg, West Virginia, which is part of Harrison County. I went to Liberty High School, and then I went to Fairmont State College. I have an accounting degree, and I have a banking degree from Fairmont State College. And from there, I started working, and I haven't stopped.
The headquarters of Lewis's company, Action Facilities Management, or AFM, overlooks I-79 near Morgantown. AFM employs more than 300 people in 9 states. In addition to commercial contracts, they provide security, maintenance, and ground services for an impressive list of government agencies.
We work for Homeland Security,
the FBI.
We do work for the Department of Defense,
the General Services Administration,
Department of State,
FEMA,
CDC, which is Centers for Disease Control,
the U.S. Navy.
We have the National Energy Technology Laboratory, and we also do work for another Department of Energy called the Office of Legacy Management,
among others. In the 1990s, Diane worked for a company in Morgantown owned by a man called Kenny Jackson. In 2001, when Jackson was winding down his company, he encouraged Diane Lewis to start her own. she did, in her basement with her teenage son as her only employee.
I told my son, I said, you're going to have to be my secretary. And he's like, I don't want to be a secretary. And I'm like, yes, you are. And so we started in slow beginnings. 2003, I started marketing to the federal government. And I actually received my certification through the U.S. Small Business Administration in Clarksburg. And I actually got our first contract in 2004.
Today, Lewis's son, Don Hill, manages the company's Washington, D.C. offices. Her daughter, Stephanie, works for the FBI. As a leader, 50-year-old Lewis aims to make sure her customers are happy.
Here's Brad.
My name is Brad Calandrelli. I'm director of facilities at the High Tech Consortium in Fairmont, West Virginia. And I first met Diane about 5.5 or 6 years ago. She cares about her clients. She checks up on us to make sure we're happy, and if there's things that aren't working well, she makes sure they get corrected. But I think she's a very good employer. The type of work that some of her employees do, the janitorial services, tend not to make a lot of money, but she makes sure that they have benefits, health care, vacation, 401k, and a lot of small companies cannot provide that to their employees, but she cares about her people and she cares about her customers.
As far as the training, the security training that they had this past weekend, can you tell me how that went?
It went well. Rick covered pretty much everything.
Dale Eagle supervises more than 20 of Diane Lewis's staff working here at the High Tech Foundation.
It's very seldom that you get to work in a company where a member of middle management can actually make a phone call to the CEO of the company and discuss business matters. It really is beneficial and helps members like myself and middle management to do our jobs when we're able to speak with Diane and other members and directors of AFM.
Incidentally, after Diane Lewis raised her son and daughter on her own, she married Kenny Jackson, the man who once encouraged her to start her own business. Today, he's a consultant for Diane's company. This successful businesswoman comes from humble, hardworking roots.
I was the youngest of 7 children. We were very poor. I didn't even realize how poor we were at the time. In our house, we had 3 bedrooms and there was 9 people in the house. So it was really crowded. I slept at the bottom of my parents' bed for the first 7 or 8 years that I can remember until one of my siblings moved out. And then I got to move up to another bed, you know, that I had to share. My dad's education, he actually went to first grade, skipped to third grade, and then he quit school when he was 8 years old.
Why did he quit school?
His family was so poor, but he was the oldest, and he actually went to work to try to help the other of his siblings. I mean, he was just a very hard worker. And my mom was born in Gilmer County. She was one of 16. And she actually went to the 11th grade. And that's at that time, from what I understand, that they moved to Clarksburg, and that's where she met my dad.
Okay, Diane, here we are in Clarksburg.
Yes, actually, we're on Route 50. And we're almost to the West Pike Street exit, and that's the exit to Adamston. Clarksburg was booming at the time. The glass factory, which was at the bottom of our hill, probably employed 200 to 300 people. You know, there was filling stations everywhere. There was bakeries. There was barber shops. There was just all kinds of business around that area. You really didn't even have to leave the Adamston area, as we called it, to go get anything. Everybody was always riding their bikes around, and there was a playground, and, you know, everybody looked out for you. When I was 8 years old, I worked at the Dairy King. And I didn't work for money. I actually worked for a hot dog and a Coke. My sister and I, Patty, we would actually go and pick up the paper and all the debris that people had left down there. And that's how I started, like 8 years old.
Right there.
Yes. It's just amazing to know that it's still there. And you'll see here, Adamston Elementary, and that's where I went to elementary school at. And this is where my dad's house used to be in now. My dad worked at Union Carbide for like 33 years. He actually had a wooden leg, and he always worked the 3 to 11 shift. So when I was coming out of school, he was always coming down the hill, and I'd just wave at him, and I'd say, I'd see you tonight when you get home. And he'd get home like between 11:30 and 12, and I could not go to sleep until I saw him at night. He always taught me never to be late. You always tell the truth, no matter what, good or bad, you tell them the truth, and that you have integrity about what you do.
When Diane started elementary school, she was just an average student.
My third grade teacher really changed my life. Her name was Mrs. Bonner. She just took me sort of under her wing. She started with my handwriting and told me I had very nice handwriting. And she, it's like she believed in me. And she told me, she says, Diane, you can do whatever you want to do. And I thought, really? And so after that, I mean, it just put me to where I tried a little harder. And next thing I knew, I was making A's. And you know, I just remember my brothers and sisters were doing mediocre. And from that point on, I decided, you know what, I'm going to give it my best. And so I give a lot of credit to her. My favorite subject was math. And I think the math is because I can remember when I was small that my parents would argue over the money. But it was a small house, so you could hear everything. And I just wanted to understand what the problem was with the money. I thought that if I understood the math, then I could understand the money. And I knew if I could understand the money, then maybe I could help them.
I'm Donna Jean Forge. I am Diane Lewis Jackson's sister. Growing up, she was very smart. When she had to study for a test, she would study for hours, and I mean hours. She was going to be the achiever in the family, and she is. She has really achieved more than any of the rest of us had. My parents would be so proud of her. If they were alive to see what she's accomplished, they would be so proud of her.
When Diane was 15, she started working at McDonald's in Clarksburg and worked there all the way through high school and college. Though her parents didn't live to see her success as an entrepreneur, she's giving back to her community in other ways. Today, along with husband Kenny Jackson, Lewis runs a nonprofit organization called Members of Diversity, helping youngsters from minority groups to develop the skills they need to find jobs. She knows from experience the hurdles you have to overcome to make it in business or anything else.
I will never know to what degree those challenges are out there, but I know when I go on bids, and I've been on walkthroughs where I actually had a white gentleman say to me, he said, well, take good notes for your boss. I'm sure he'll need them. He automatically assumed I could not own the company. And then after I won, he called me up and said, could he do anything to help me? And he didn't realize that I owned the company and it was his mistake and that he would never make that mistake again. But, you know, it happens. I don't know if it's a disadvantage sometimes or more of an advantage because they underestimate me a lot of times.
Lewis is a director of a group called Teaming to Win, one of the largest and most successful events in West Virginia for small businesses. She also serves on the Board of Governors of West Virginia University.
Anybody, if you spent 10 minutes with her, you walk away going, oh my gosh, what a great woman, what a great person. And that's who she is.
James Clements, president of West Virginia University.
The first thing you notice about Diane, she's got an incredible smile. And what it shows is her warmth. And if you ever look into her eyes, you can just tell she's such a good person. She's wonderful on the board. She's an amazing leader, an entrepreneur. So many things about Diane jump out as special. One that shows how special she is, and I think her husband, Kenny, we have four children. Our youngest is Grace, who is the love of our life. Grace has multiple special needs, and she's just the sweetest girl in the world. She's 12. Grace just loves Diane and Kenny. She just loves them. So anytime they come to a football game, Grace wants to sit with them. Grace wants to be with them. You almost think they treat Grace like she's one of theirs. But again, it's her love for everyone and her kindness that becomes attractive to anybody who's near her.
Earlier this year, Diane Lewis was named the Small Business Person of the Year in West Virginia. Her employees and customers alike were delighted. Brad Calandrelli.
She could go elsewhere and make a living doing what she does, but she likes living here. She likes this area. West Virginians are a different group of people. They're proud to be from West Virginia. And people who leave can't wait to get back. We're fortunate that she decided to stay here.
Tell me what you enjoy most about running this company.
I enjoy watching the faces of my employees. When I go to a site and whenever they walk up to me and they thank me for having health insurance, they thank me because they're able to buy a new car, they thank me because they've been able to qualify for a home loan, or they're putting their children through college. And whenever I see the product and service and the customer's happy and the employee's happy, it's the best feeling in the world.
In life, we all have been given opportunities to make a difference in someone else's life. Many times I think we don't even realize the impact that we might have. Diane is one, I am sure, just as that third grade teacher positively changed her life, she's done it over and over and over and over again for many people.
In most cases, a novel or biography inspires a film, but for journalist and author Will Haygood, the sequence has been dramatically different. A November 7, 2008 article by Haygood in the Washington Post inspired the Lee Daniels film, The Butler, and then Haygood went back to write the book. West Virginia Public Radio's Dave Mistich has more on the author, his subject, and the lengths he went through to tell a story that's been captivating the nation.
Growing up in Columbus, Ohio, and graduating from Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, Haygood took his first job in journalism as a copy editor at the Charleston Gazette. It was while here in West Virginia that Haygood began focusing on arts and human interest stories. Eventually, he went on to jobs in larger markets, like Pittsburgh and Boston, before winding up in the nation's capital at the Washington Post. While on the presidential campaign trail in 2008, following then-U.S. Senator Barack Obama, Haygood turned his attention to other timely and culturally relevant topics.
I wanted to find somebody, an African American, who had worked in the White House during the era of segregation, because I thought that story juxtaposed against the story of the first African American president in the country would be a pretty powerful story.
And so Haygood launched a nationwide search to find a subject that could illuminate the historical gravity of what he saw as Obama's impending victory.
I was essentially looking for a ghost because I didn't have a name. And then eventually somebody in Florida mentioned the name of Eugene Allen and told me that he lived in the Washington, D.C., Maryland region. I tracked him down.
Haygood says unraveling the story of the now famous butler took a special level of care he had rarely, if ever, experienced before.
My grandparents raised me, so I lived in their house as a kid, you know, so I knew the value of being patient. And Mr. and Mrs. Allen were elderly people by the time I reached them. And so I kind of had a sense that, you know, it might not be the best thing to do to sit down and start trying to grab information out of them. And so I was very patient. Matter of fact, they wanted to watch a couple TV shows, game shows, before we actually got to interviews underway, and then there were several hours before he took me down the basement and showed me this room, you know, with all sorts of memorabilia.
By the end of the day that his original article was published, a mere 3 days after Obama's win, calls began to pour in from Hollywood executives. Haygood says it was partly a matter of timing mixed with a cultural and historical juxtaposition too important to ignore.
He was a character that nobody had heard about, you know, and he was a character who had seen vivid American history up close. He lived at the most powerful address in the country, and yet in the 50s and early 60s, he could go to his native Virginia and have to use a segregated bathroom. And so the twin engines of those two narratives, Obama winning and Mr. Allen's life story, I think, proved a real magnet to Hollywood interest.
And so Haygood was enlisted as a researcher and associate producer for Lee Daniels' film, The Butler. It was an experience that he says was difficult to believe.
I don't think anyone can ever say that they dreamed of being on a movie set with six Oscar winners and making a movie based on the story that you wrote. Yeah, no, it's just too unreal to even think that. And so, you know, there's some mornings I still have to pinch myself.
As production on the film began, Haygood decided to put together a full-length written treatment of Eugene Allen's incredible story. Haygood's book, The Butler, A Witness to History, was released in June, and Daniels' film adaptation of the story was released in August. Through it all, Haygood says he cherishes the opportunity to meet and tell the story of the White House butler who endured 8 presidencies and witnessed the moments that shaped our nation and culture.
It was a pretty astonishing find to to come across a man who nobody knew about, who had almost, you know, had this sort of Forrest Gump-like life. You know, he was there during all these epical moments of White House history for 34 years, and it was just a special, special story to do.
Haygood has also written award-winning biographies on the enigmatic New York congressman, Adam Clayton Powell Jr., and famed member of the Rat Pack, Sammy Davis Jr. His latest book, Sweet Thunder, The Life and Times of Sugar Ray Robinson, is currently in the developmental stages for a film. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Dave Mistich in Charleston.
Marshall University students were able to meet a civil rights-era freedom rider this week. As West Virginia Public Radio's Clark Davis reports, Joan C. Browning told her story on the 50th anniversary of the rides.
The riders were a group of men and women who boarded buses and trains headed for the Deep South in 1961 to test the 1960 Supreme Court ruling outlawing segregation in interstate public facilities. What makes Browning's perspective different, though, is that she's Caucasian.
I felt very lucky. I really felt that I was in the right place doing the right thing, and whatever happened then or later, you know, for one time in my life, I did the right thing.
Browning was at Marshall University this week as part of Constitution Week. While on campus, she spoke to classes about what her experiences were like.
I was one of the few white people who was involved in the black freedom struggle in the South in the early 60s and the sit-in movement, and I was a freedom rider and picketed and things of that nature. So I'm sort of the oddity that you don't expect in when you read about the civil rights movement.
Browning joined the Freedom Riders after attending an all-black Methodist church in Milledgeville, Georgia. As a result of her church attendance, she was thrown out of Georgia State College for Women. In June of 1961, she moved to Atlanta, where she discovered the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee that would later organize the Freedom Rides. Browning says it excites her when she sees young people following in her footsteps, standing up for things they believe in.
When the Occupy movement first started, I was very excited. I thought that it was possibly the beginning of a mass resurgence of young people and empower people to take to the streets, literally.
Browning volunteered with SNCC on projects in Georgia and Alabama, worked in human relations and anti-poverty programs throughout the 60s, and was an organizer of the Federation of Southern Cooperatives. In the end, Browning says she still speaks to classes and groups because she wants people to know, no matter their situation, they still have power.
I want them to say, know that young people have power. Poor people have power. Old people have power. You know, the Grey Panthers came out of the model of the Freedom Rides. I want people to feel that this is your world and you have a chance, you have a right to make it the way you want it to and find other people and don't give up, don't give in.
Browning now lives in Greenbrier County and has a degree from West Virginia State University. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Clark Davis in Huntington.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. The West Virginia Library Commission is hoping folks across the state will read Kentucky Poet Laureate Frank X. Walker's book, Afralachia. The Book of Poetry is this year's choice for the One Book, One West Virginia Common Reading Program. Walker, who is director of the African American and Africana Studies Program at the University of Kentucky, spent most of this past week as the Appalachian Writer-in-Residence at Shepherd University, where he took time to talk with me about his career as a writer and artist activist. Why do you do poetry versus other types of writing?
Well, that's the myth about me. People know about my poetry, but I'm trained as a fiction writer. I spent 10 years as a playwright. My first real job out of college was as a journalist. I don't think of myself as a poet. I think of myself as a writer, and I'd like to think I'm competent in more than one genre. I've finished a novel, which I hope will be in bookstores in the next few years, but I've had more success as a poet, admittedly.
What is it about poetry that attracted you to make that a primary form of communication?
Well, I think that what happened with me in poetry has more to do with, as my life became more complicated, as far as how much time I had to spend on certain kinds of things. You know, I was a young parent, working multiple jobs to feed my daughter and to take care of myself and to pay for school. That didn't leave me a lot of time to write. And I had to travel a lot, which makes it difficult to write larger things like fiction. But I can write a poem on an airplane or driving down 64 from Lexington to Louisville. I can write a poem in a hotel room anywhere, but I can't write anything bigger than that in any of those spaces. So I think that, you know, my productivity as a poet is just a function and byproduct of how limited my time has been.
So you have become more a poet by necessity?
Yeah, I think as an artist, you have to create something. You need that sense of satisfaction to make sure that you actually are an artist. You need some evidence of your artistry. And, you know, if I just looked at my failed fiction projects, I'd probably feel like a failure. But I can look at successful poems that appeared in journals and anthologies, and then the collections that the poems appeared in, and feel like, okay, I'm producing art, so I'm an artist, I'm a writer.
One of the things I find interesting about your poetry is that a lot of your books, when you pick them up, are not just books of random poetry. They are almost novels in poetry form. You have the historical poetry novel books. Talk a little bit about what led you to approach poetry that way.
Well, you know, I think that if I wasn't an English teacher, I'd teach history. And I think that, you know, whatever we bring to the page is a byproduct of who we are in the real world. And my love for history has found its way into my writing. But I'm particularly drawn to historical subjects that have been told incorrectly or have been told, and in that telling, it rendered individuals or people invisible. So I'm working against that invisibility. The Lewis and Clark book was important to me because I got to tell it from the point of view of York. Most people who know Lewis and Clark don't know the story of York, and I think it's an incomplete story if you take York out of it, or York's enslaved wife, or Native Americans in general. And so I had a chance to erase some of that invisibility with those two books. The same thing with Isaac Murphy. You know, I got to tell the story of the true history of thoroughbred racing, at least in Kentucky and the region. A lot of people see the current version of the Kentucky Derby and don't know how it started, how different that reality is. So part of my job as an artist activist is to do that. The latest book that has historical ties is about Medgar Evers, and, you know, young people don't seem to know who he is, and they haven't been taught a broad enough civil rights era story that it includes Medgar Evers. So I'm trying to make him, you know, the title's called Unghosting, of Medgar Evers. So I'm trying to bring him back into the conversation. So it's not just history, it's those people whose historical importance have been erased.
One of the things you focused on in your career is making people realize that Appalachia isn't just a white place. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about what African Americans have brought in culture and art to the region.
Well, that's always an easy response for me, and it's really hard to imagine how the caricatures and stereotypes of Appalachia have survived so well in the face of the hard evidence that puts people like Carter G. Woodson, who's the father of African American history, in the middle of that equation, and puts Nina Simone and Bill Withers and Roberta Flack and Skip Gates and Negro League Baseball and August Wilson and all his African American theater. You know, if you add all those, you know, to those hollow negative stereotypes like Little Abner and Snuffy Smith, it changed the equation. And I think the challenge is, when people talk about the region, is to first not see it as homogeneous and all white. And to acknowledge that it's broad enough to include a Birmingham and a Pittsburgh, that is both rural and urban. And only then will we be able to shake away from those hard and false stereotypes and caricatures that are still pervasive. And it's a shame. And I think it's the only people who can do it are people who live in this space and work in this space. That outsiders are not going to do it, because I think they still enjoy the power of having somebody to laugh at. But they're laughing at something that's not true.
Why do you think it's important to dispel the myth?
Well, because I think that anywhere there are negative caricatures and stereotypes of people, they should be done away with. And I think it's, the self-respect and attitudes of the children who live here, they need to not believe that those things are about them. They need to know those things are false. They need to know that they have value and worth, and they can project themselves into spaces in the world that may not seem available if they believe those negative stereotypes and limitations. If no other reason, just for the children, and because it's a lie, that's the big thing.
You are an Appalachian writer, so what is your contribution, do you think, to the literary works of Appalachia?
Well, I would say my contributions include forcing a discussion of the true diversity of the region. I would say my contributions include getting people to recommit to poetry. I think to kind of erase this myth about poetry not belonging to everybody. Part of my work is missionary work. I'm trying to recruit new fans of poetry, people who not just appreciate poetry, but recognize that they need some and want some of that in their life. And as a teacher of young writers and artists, I think that my contribution is teaching and educating the next generation of artists and writers from the region.
Well, Frank X. Walker, Poet Laureate of Kentucky, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. 229 million people speak English in the United States. Around 35 million speak Spanish, and roughly 3 million speak Chinese. But in the Smoky Mountains of North Carolina, there are only a few hundred people left speaking a language and dialect that once was heard across a wide part of the South. WUOT's Christine Jessel reports the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians is struggling to preserve not just their language, but their cultural identity.
At the Nugadua Academy in Cherokee, North Carolina, a sign above the door reads, "English stops here."
English is what you would consider a cancerous language. It just devours other indigenous languages.
Renissa McLaughlin manages the Gadua Preservation and Education Program for the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians. She's fighting to revitalize a dying language.
The language is just not this novel thing that a couple of old people do on the side. It is the heart and soul of who we are as Cherokee people.
By most estimates, there are less than 200 to 300 native Cherokee speakers in the territory in western North Carolina. Many of them are old. Many of them are sick. And in 20 years, not many of them will be left.
Most people would say if you lose your language, you've lost your culture, or you are in great danger of losing your culture.
Gerald Trodel is an anthropology professor at the University of Tennessee. Of the 500 to 600 American Indian languages once heard in North America, he says less than a third are still spoken today.
And of all those, there are only, 46 that people estimate are viable languages. In other words, there's enough adults and enough children learning the language that these languages are likely to continue.
In North Carolina, Michelle Hicks is the Eastern Band's principal chief. He's heavily invested in creating native speakers. Hicks says the Nugadua Academy is part of a bigger initiative to save the language from extinction. The tribe and other funders have poured millions of dollars into language revitalization programs.
You can't put a dollar value to an effect on
protecting your tribe and who you are. It's just something that each one of us as Cherokee members knows from our heart what it means.
Inside the school, every word spoken is supposed to be in Cherokee. The technique is called immersion, and at Nugadua Academy, kids begin when they're a few months old. There are around 90 children enrolled through the fourth grade. Renissa McLaughlin says they're in a race against time.
While we are hopeful and we have vision, the reality is that we are tapping out our resources. People are retiring. People are tired.
This is Africa.
Bo Lossie oversees curriculum at the Nugadua Academy. Lossie says he regrets not learning his own language and cultural heritage from his grandfather when he had the chance. But he says he's keeping his grandfather's memory close by serving as a bridge between fluent speakers and future speakers.
It's a sense of identity. And it seems like that's a whole lot of burden for such a few amount of students, but it truly is. It's a sense of knowing who you are. Like the word Cherokee itself is, that's not who we are. We're Ani Gaduwagi, you know, we're the people of Gaduwa.
Lossie says as long as there are speakers, there's hope. The language, like the Cherokee people, will endure. In Knoxville, I'm Christine Jessel.
West Virginia celebrated another sesquicentennial moment this past week. The official state seal turned 150 years old on Thursday. On September 26, 1863, lawmakers in the newly formed state of West Virginia adopted the state seal designed by Joseph Hubert Distabar of Doddridge County. In the 150 years since, the state seal has never been changed. The front of the seal, which shows a coal miner and farmer representing industry and agriculture, a rock engraved with the date of statehood, and two rifles crossed beneath the Cap of Liberty, has become a symbol of West Virginia. According to the West Virginia Encyclopedia, the seal was designed and adopted with two sides, but only the front is in common use. The reverse side of the seal is the governor's seal. The Secretary of State is the official keeper of the state seal. Sun, wind, light, and shadows are featured in a new exhibit called Following the Sun Part 2 at Pittsburgh's Mattress Factory. The Allegheny Front's Jennifer Shveta Jordan visited with the artist to talk about the exhibit.
It's fall arts season, an occasion we don't typically recognize here on the Allegheny Front. But at the Mattress Factory Art Gallery in Pittsburgh, a Detroit couple recently installed an exhibit to get people to think about the environment. I stopped by to check it out. The husband and wife artists behind Design 99, Mitchell Cope and Gina Reichert, explained what it's all about.
This is our installation titled Following the Sun, Part 2. It comes from a piece we've been working on in Detroit called the Powerhouse Project, where we've turned a house, a city house, into an off-the-grid experiment for us and for other artists.
Well, I was just going to say, what you're looking at on the monitors is actually this, the Pittsburgh sky. So I guess we built out this space just to really think about the sky.
The sun, the wind, the environment, sort of out these windows.
What you can't see are the three wind turbines and three solar panels that are on the roof that, when it gets cold, will provide heat in the gallery space. But through these little dump resistor heaters that kind of look like toaster ovens, they'll be warming the rocks that'll then warm the room.
Those are...
pictured rocks?
Rocks from northern Michigan. From the Pictured Rocks area, and we brought them over here from Michigan to kind of serve as
represent
Michigan, but also kind of anchor the exhibit. And then as you walk through the exhibit, you get into the videos and also a little bit of a quiet space with a felt-lined area of the room to kind of contemplate and be quiet. So there's several layers to the exhibit, including all the colors that represent the landscape, and also the heat, shadows and light.
Those were artists Mitchell Cope and Gina Reichert speaking about their new exhibit at Pittsburgh's Mattress Factory Installation Art Gallery. I'm Jennifer Shveta Jordan.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpubcast.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpubcast.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.